All right, another episode of Confessions of a Street Broker, and with me today is the prettiest man in industrial real estate. my longtime buddy, man, Haynes Chatham. I'm glad you're here.
Hey, thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah. So, I started probably 2 years after you did, and we've been on the streets ever since together. So this is fun. We've got a lot of history. So your partner's running the industrial team there. So what? Let's just get into it, man. Like, give us your background. Where'd you start? Where'd you grow up? How'd you get here?
So I'm originally from Aubrey, Texas, which is north of Denton.
Okay.
Grew up on a quarter horse ranch. So It's funny because whenever people think of like Texas and people riding around in cowboys and like, that's my dad. My dad's a legit cowboy. So grew up in Aubrey. And then when I was about middle school, parents split up and one went to Arlington and one went to Fort Worth. And so kind of lived in within an hour of Dallas my entire life and wound up going to SMU for school and stayed in Dallas and got into commercial real estate.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
SMU is definitely the pipeline for commercial real estate, man. That's what Jeff's son's there right now.
He's playing football for him too, right?
He was. He had a PWO there, played 1 year, and I think he just wanted to go to school. You know, man, I'll tell you what, I think being a walk-on is extremely tough because they're just going to bring in a guy that, this guy at NC State wants to leave and has already played. Let's just bring him in. Oh, let's just bring this guy in. And so, you know, I think that's a tough row.
Tougher during your scholarship.
I think you either have to be very special or you have to be maybe at another school, smaller school, and be able to showcase film to go up. So, but no, he's really smart. He got an academic scholarship. So, he's getting all geared up to, I'm sure he'll go work at Mercer Company. Yeah. He's definitely the guy. And actually Jeff's other son, Jack, is fixing to start at Mercer Company too. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's cool. So, so SMU, you get out and do you go straight into commercial real estate?
So I actually started interning for Trey Fricke when I was in school. And so Trey at the time was at the NAI affiliate before Robert Lynn. It was called NAI Stoneley.
Yep.
Doesn't exist anymore. And so Transwestern acquired them. So I was interning for Trey at NAI Stoneley. And then my senior year, they got bought out. Trey didn't want to go to Transwestern. So he and Nathan Denton, Ken Wesson, and all those guys, they went and started Lee & Associates. So when they started the Lee & Associates office in Dallas, that was actually my senior year at SMU.
Yeah.
So when I graduated, wound up, it's kind of funny. I actually didn't go straight back to working with Trey because I was getting paid as an intern and I wasn't really the best intern. And I had a buddy, this was in, I guess, 2006, 2007, and the real estate market was on fire. And I had a buddy that was working as a lender that like graduated, it was making like six figures his first year out of school. So Trey was like, you know, it's 100% commission, no benefits, but like, and I was like, man, I can't do that right now. And so I went and worked as a lender for a year, made a bunch of money, saved up some money and missed it and wound up calling up Trey. And Trey's like, man, I already hired somebody. And I was just like, you know, kind of had that old oh shit moment. And he's like, but Nathan Denton is going to need somebody in 6 months. And so wound up going to Lee 6 months later. And Nathan and I teamed up and worked together for 3 years and loved it over there. So that's kind of how I got into commercial real estate full time.
God, I can only imagine the Nathan Denton, Haynes Chatham, Lady Killer team.
Oh my God. We had a lot of fun.
The two hottest men in industrial real estate.
We had a blast.
Oh man, it's funny. I had Stephen Williams sitting here the other day and he was talking about, yeah, I wanted to start an office. I was like, well, Nathan Denton should have been in office. You know, we always joke. I always joke that office brokers are like the perfect humans. You know, they all look great and everything. And
especially when we got into it, it's like now everybody wants to be an industrial.
Oh, yeah.
But like back in the day, you know, industrial. I always asked Trey and Nathan why they got into it. And they're like, it was basically like, hey, give me a big fish in a small pond. Cause, yeah. you know, a lot of the industrial guys back then were, I mean, they kind of carried themselves like used car salesmen.
Oh, yeah.
And so if you were a professional, looked the part, worked hard, I mean, you could kind of be at the top of the food chain. And so when I had interned at NAI Stoneley, I did like a semester with Trey, and then I went and tried the office side because they were like, hey, why don't you come check this out? And so I went and interned for Nora Hogan and Robert Deptula.
Yeah.
Do you know those guys? And I was like, man, all these guys, they're in the office all day.
Yeah.
And like the whole fun of commercial brokerage to me was like, I like being outside, like hitting the streets, meeting mm-hmm. people. I don't want to be in a cube all day dialing for dollars.
Yeah.
And so I did that for a semester, and I was like, this isn't for me.
You know, what's funny is like, so when we started in industrial, it's like back then, like no one cared about those buildings.
No.
Like we couldn't give those buildings away to people. Like, it's like, hey, this is $30 a foot. And they're like,
yeah,
just turn their nose up at it.
And $3 now, gross deals. Oh. I mean, it was.
So that's what, you know, I when I get OPEX quoted to me now, I'm like, I literally used to lease buildings on a gross basis for what OPEX are now on assets.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I've sold buildings in the teens in Brook Hollow. Like, it's crazy.
I know.
And now, you know, just add a zero behind that because that's what they're trading at, so, you know? So, and, you know, we talk about that sometimes. We were talking about that earlier. Like, I don't buy in Brook Hollow because I don't think I fundamentally understand it anymore like I used to, where I could actually be an investor in it. So,
oh, well. That's changed a lot.
We'll find other things. So, you're at Lee for 2 years, right?
I was at Lee for three. It was like 2 years and 10 months.
Okay.
And when I was at Lee, Nathan back in the day used to work like Addison Metro, Valwood, and then Hines. But he'd also have like listings in South Dallas and all over. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I was kind of the, you know, I was the grunt out having to handle all the showings. I was kind of all over the place. And my last year, I was like, man, I need to really like focus on one sub-market. I mean, I was doing a ton of transactions, but I wasn't making a lot of money my first 2 years just because I was spread too thin and mm-hmm. bouncing from submarket to submarket. And so he's like, great, we don't have anybody in Brook Hollow. Go to Brook Hollow. And at the time, Jeff was still at Robert Lynn.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, everywhere was like Stream, Jason Moser, and David Dewey or Jeff Mercer. And yeah. so I was just out, you know, cold calling like crazy, knocking on doors. And I think Jason Moser, he told me after the fact, he's like, I'd go meet with clients, I'd just see your card in all their offices. And yeah. so he and Davey decided to like split up their partnership. And yeah. so Jason was looking for a partner.
Mm-hmm.
And so he just kind of approached me, and you know, it was kind of I liked Lee, wasn't really interested. And then like after a courting process and like after also just like banging my head against the wall because Jeff and Jason dominated that submarket, I was like, man, maybe it makes sense to join forces with Jason here and go to Stream, go to Brook Hollow. And they made me a kind of an offer I couldn't refuse to come over. And so, and I loved all the Lee guys. It was a very emotional and challenging decision to leave. And so then I went over to Stream and worked with Jason doing Design District in South Stemmons for 12 and a half years. So yeah. it was a hell of a run.
Yeah, no, it, yeah, I could see leaving Lee would be tough. It's a good group of dudes.
They're
over
buddies,
there.
Yeah. yeah. And, I'm still close with Nathan and Trey and all those guys. So it was hard, but it was just it was a financial decision. And at the time, you know, Stream didn't have, this was pre-Boozer. And back then, mm-hmm. like, I think Jason Moser and David Dewey were like the only two what I call street brokers over there. More institutional leasing, and the fact that they just wanted somebody to get out and go knock on doors. And you know, no one really wants to train guys, I feel like, as much anymore. Like, you know, once you're 2-3 years in the business, everyone tries to start poaching you.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you know how to cold call, you know, you're generating some revenue, and then they try to poach you to come over. And that's kind of what happened. It was just like a great opportunity. And they're like, hey, you know, we need someone in the Design District and work in Brook Hollow with Moser. And Moser had, you know, dozens of listings. So day one, I had stuff to peddle, and then we just never looked back. So it was a good transition. Plus back then the market, you know, this was right after like the market crashed.
Yeah.
And so it was just tough to make money. And I was getting a lot of transactional experience at Lee, but just wasn't making a lot of money. So yeah. going to Stream, and it was a hell of a run.
Yeah. So Stream was really about the time you start, where did you start at Stream?
2010.
Okay. So I started in 2010. I started in Brook Hollow. You're in Brook Hollow. You know, I think we kind of instantly just hit it off immediately. Yeah. You know, the one thing, and you know, I always kind of felt with brokers is man, like, they're your competitors, but like, you better be friends with these guys too, because you're going to be in their sandbox and they're going to be in your sandbox. And I'll tell you the one thing that I always loved when you had a listing or I had a listing and the other person had the prospect, because it was like, hey, bro, this is your deal to lose. I'm going to tell you how to make it, you know? And I think that's really important to have relationships with your competitors in your markets, because it'll help you get a lot of deals done, you know?
I agree.
And, you know, help you get a lot of deals done before you even list a property. You can make a couple phone calls and it might be like, hey, dude, don't list it. I got it. I got this guy. We'll be there tomorrow. We'll look at it. Boom, boom, done. You know what I mean? Like, so I always appreciated that about our relationship, and, you know, that it was kind of like, all right, man, you got the guy for this. All right, we're getting this done. Yeah. So
done a lot of deals together over the years.
Yeah, for sure. So, and same thing with Jason, man. You know, Jason was, you know, always, you know, you and Jason, you know, we were always head to head, you know, and done a ton of deals with Jason, and, you know, it's funny, you know, both of y'all have invested with us now and all that stuff. And so, you know, just love having, you know, I remember Jason also one time I had a listing on Roundtable and him and his dad owned a property over there, and it was adjacent, and they actually hired me to list it because it made more sense for me to have the contiguous piece. And we got a lease for him. So, you know, it's not always competitors. It's, you know, you're kind of working together. So that's what it was always fun about working with you. And so then you're at Stream for 12 years. You know, I'll be honest with you, I kind of felt like you and Jason never really fit the Stream model to me, in my opinion. I felt like y'all were just kind of y'all were like a different subset for them. Like, y'all weren't like what Stream does. And so I don't know. It just seemed like Stream was more institutional, and there's nothing institutional about Brook Hollow, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, there's a few other guys, you know, Adam Jones, James Mansouranis. So, but you're right. Like, overall, they've got, you know, Eric Crutchfield. So you've got your kind of like what I call the street broker guys, and then you got your institutional guys.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was, I loved Stream. I don't think I would have ever left Stream for another company in Dallas.
Yeah.
And so I'd been recruited a lot, and I really always felt like I'd be at Stream forever. And then until Mike and Lee sold, because I was like, eventually they're going to, you know, someone's going to come in, offer them a bunch of money, and it'll get rolled up into one of the big publicly traded companies.
Yeah.
And then we used to talk about it. I was like, yeah, whenever that happens, and like, you know, some of the industrial guys go branch off and go start basically like our own Mercer company, like some market specialists. And I kind of always felt like that was going to happen. And then Partners came calling, and, you know, they were the NAI affiliate before.
Oh, okay.
So they're it was NAI Partners. They went through a rebranding like a few months before I got there, specifically because they wanted to come to Dallas and they couldn't because NAI Robert Lynn was here.
Right.
And so they were NAI Partners and had offices in Austin, Houston, San Antonio.
Yeah.
And they called me up, and I was kind of like, guys, like, thanks, but not really interested. And Jared Hangartner calls me. He's like, hey, let's go have lunch. And I knew him. And I was like, okay, I'll take this lunch. And so, you know, their model is like very similar to Stream, which was as far as like how they want to grow, you know, organically. And so they flew me down to Houston, and I was like, whatever, I'll go down, check it out. And it was kind of funny because I didn't know what I was getting myself into. And it was almost like speed dating. Like, I mean, I didn't even realize they were interviewing me. I was kind of told like, hey, we want you in here. And I went down to meet with a few guys, and every guy I met with, we just hit it off. We were in a conference room, and they'd go grab another partner. They'd bring him in, and I was supposed to be down there all day. And then we went and had lunch, and they're like, look, like, this has never happened before. Every one of the partners met with you, loves you. Like, what's it going to take to get you over here? And that was kind of humbling. And I was like, man, you know, we deal in market. Like, I don't even know what market is. Like, well, what do you guys want to offer me? And my big deal was like, I was never going to leave Stream unless it was for a company where I could have like equity and try to grow something.
Yeah.
I mean, that was something I always wanted. And so they gave me that opportunity, and we're opening up Atlanta in June.
Okay.
And so, you know, I'm a partner in the Dallas office, but I'm also a partner in like the in all the offices, which was just, it was such a good opportunity. I couldn't turn it down. So it wasn't a stream thing. It was like, I would have been stupid not to take the opportunity. So yeah. It's going great. So
that's good. No, it's, you know, I've kind of taken the position in my life going forward that I really don't work on things unless I have ownership in them. I think that's where you need to be, especially at your point in your career.
Yeah.
You need to be a principal of something. Like, I mean, you've done it. There's, you know, and so that's awesome, man. I'm really happy for you with that.
Thanks.
And yeah, I didn't think you were ever leaving stream either. Like, it's funny. I mean, hell, I thought you'd probably come to Mercer Company if you went anywhere. Because hell, you used to go to our
freaking, yeah. I mean, you guys were all my buddies.
You'd go to Mercer Company events. You'd be like this one outside. Broker going to Mercer Company broker events.
So, it's so funny you said that. Yeah. When I resigned, or when it got the announcement that I was leaving came out, like Nathan called me and was like, dude, like what's going on? If I knew you were looking, like you should have come back to Lee. And I was like, man, I want it. And even when I resigned, Stream was shocked. They're like, we thought you would have gone to Mercer Company or Lee and Associates. Like they didn't even know really who Partners was, but I thought that was funny. But you know, if I was ever looking to make a move, I would have gone and talked to Jeff and I would have gone back and talked to Nathan. But this came out of nowhere. I mean, I think it was a year ago, Thanksgiving, they approached me. And like before Christmas, I'd made my decision. Like it was just one of those things, like prayed about it, felt right, loved all the partners. You know, Houston NAI or Partners is the third largest full service brokerage shop in Houston.
Oh, okay.
Like, so I mean, they're huge. And, and like the industrial team remind me a lot of all the guys at Stream.
Mm-hmm.
So just like an immediate comfort level. And one of the partners down there is best buddies with one of my best friends from college. And so there's just kind of a comfort level. And so building out the full service platform now, and it's going well. So
that's awesome. Yeah. No, we, Will and I went down to Houston a couple weeks ago. We met with the partners, some of the partners guys, and, you know, they got a pretty impressive shop down there. And, you know, I've just known their brand. Like we were talking a second ago, Carlos down in San Antonio, I love working with him. He's repping us on a deal right now. So those are there's a lot of good brokers at Partners. So that, so it's always been a pleasure for us to work with them, and they've helped me out in other markets, you know? And so,
yeah, they're good guys.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. What was the most awkward cold call you ever made?
Yeah, it's funny because I knew you were going to ask me that question. It's a good question. And I was listening the other day to your interview with Keenan.
Yeah.
And it's funny, like, because I kind of have the same approach in that, like, I feel like your memory's got to be short when you're cold calling, because otherwise, like, how do you do what we do?
Right.
And I can't remember. I can't think. I mean, there's bad ones every week, but it's like, I don't remember a worse cold call, but there's been some really sticky situations over the years, you know, just working on transactions and weird things going down. But I can't think of my strangest cold calling incident. I've been able to, I guess, block those out over the years.
Just compartmentalize that and put it away and exactly. Go back the next month.
That's right.
I don't even remember what happened.
Yeah. You gotta have a short memory like that stuff. Otherwise it just becomes a beating. But
yeah.
Just try to stay optimistic and positive and keep going.
Yeah. No, well, tell me about probably like one of your most unique deals you pulled off. We always kind of have this like deal that was like, you know, I can think of mine was always like the Mary Kay deal that we pulled off. And like, you know, there's always like a deal that, you know, what kind of stands out to you in your career that was really interesting type deal?
That's a good question too. I mean, there's been multiple deals that we've sold and flipped for clients for, especially over this last cycle.
Yeah.
You know, in like a 12 to 18 month period, stuff like that. You know, helping M2G with Proto Part.
Yeah.
And the acquisition of that, and the fact that I mean, I think it's under contract now for like $36 million. And, you know, that 240,000 square foot kind of urban infill redevelopment was a really fun one to work on.
But, it's funny, you know, Proto Park, I didn't touch it, but I got paid on it on the sale.
Did you really?
Yeah. Cause I kind of put it all in motion. I knew Romy was fixing to drop it and he's like, I'm dropping this. I was like, let me make a couple phone calls. And I kind of got it all teed up. For M2G. And so, and then I think David sold it to him. Gwen sold it to him, but I don't think they retain him. They immediately went to y'all for leasing on it, right?
Yeah. So it was a weird deal. So we had it leased from the listed with the previous owner.
Okay.
But it was for lease. Like the ownership was like, literally when we went and pitched for it, they're like, if you bring us purchase offers, we're going to fire you. We get approached all the time selling it. We're not going to sell this deal. Yeah. And so we weren't covered on the sale. And so Stephen Williamson took the deal to Cantex and they agreed to terms. And so we called the ownership. Moser and I, and we're like, you know, what the hell? Like, we literally, we know Cantex. We could have done this deal.
Yeah.
You told us we would get fired if we brought you a purchase officer. Like, why are you doing this? And then, so when Cantex dropped it, you know, we had kind of known, and we got taken care of it. Cause I mean, I know you're involved, but like M2G and some of the other groups. And so, once it got closed, M2G gave us the listing and we're just really involved in that repositioning. But it's funny because when we started that, I think our first deal was at like 750 triple net. And you know, the last deal I did at Stream before I left was a deal, and it was like, I want to say it was at 1050. And I remember getting that listing, and Moser and I were like, I don't know how we're going to lease this thing at these rates. And every time we did a lease, they would raise the price. And it was just back when the market was just going like this.
Mm-hmm.
And every deal we did, you know, we'd raise the price, got it done again. And it was just a really, really fun project. I'm really glad for M2G because, I mean, they crushed it.
Yeah.
I mean, based on where they were selling it. I mean, I had clients going in offering 28 to 32 million for it. They didn't even make the second round. And when Newmark came out at 36 million, I was like, there's no way in hell they can get this price. And they did. And it might have actually sold for above it. I mean, I know they had got offers at ask, and then they did like the second round. So, I mean, that's just wild.
You know, when y'all started leasing that and the rates y'all were quoting, I was like, dude, no way. You know what, though? That means they picked the right listing broker on it, because I probably would have told them, nah.
A lot of uncomfortable leasing calls. They're like, we need comps. They're like, there aren't comps to support this, but we caught lightning in the bottle. And we had sold a off-market deal where UT Southwestern is at like 29 North Stemmons, the stuff Cantex bought. Mm-hmm. So we sold that off-market to Cantex.
I own that building with them.
Did you?
That was a good deal.
Yeah. So they... We had a distillery that wanted to come in and lease like 70,000 square feet. And we had agreed to terms. We're about to move the leases. And then UT Southwestern comes knocking. And so, I mean, obviously with like UT Southwestern credit pivoted, you know, this distillery had nowhere to go. And so we had just started renovations on Proto Park. So we went and told the distillers, like, hey, sorry you lost out on this. And they were pissed off at us. And we're like, hey, we got a great backup plan for you. Come check out Proto Park. So they wound up going there and like leasing like 60,000 square feet. And at that time, it was all projections, right? Because, I mean, construction hadn't even started.
Yeah.
We had M2G, to their credit, did a really good job with like renderings and plans and made it look like it was going to be, you know, like the Taj Mahal.
Yeah.
And so we got two huge deals done before the renovations, I mean, had really even started. And the other one was a group coming out of the design district. So we kind of hit lightning, caught lightning in the bottle. Building was over half leased. And then, you know, each time we pushed rates, you know, a lot of it was like people that wanted to be close to Love Field or the design district.
Yeah.
And I mean, if that product delivered today, I don't know that you could get those same rates that we accomplished, but it was, I mean, it's a hell of a case study because, I mean, they got in, got it leased up, and, you know, they're going to crush it on the exit.
The distillery, were they represented by a guy at Cushman & Wakefield?
Yeah, I think he's over at CBRE now, the former Navy SEAL office tenant rep guy.
Yes, yes. Okay, so in the middle of all that, I had a listing in West Dallas. God, I can't even remember the street now. I'd sold the building to Greenway, and then we were leasing it for Greenway, and we had agreed to terms with those guys to sell them the building, and then they kind of started going away, and that's when I figured out they got focused on 2929, because I'd go talk to Romy and I'd be like, because I own the building with them, and I was like, oh, the distillery, who's repping them? And I was like, oh man, that's where they're going. So I ended up losing that deal.
It's funny because, like, you know, I don't do a lot of big office tenor up deals. And I knew of this guy just because he was a former Navy SEAL and met him at some real estate events. And we're working on this deal. And you know, we didn't know if we were going to get there. And he calls us up and he's like, hey, like, if you guys pay us a broker bonus, you know, an extra point on the deal, like, I'll get this deal done for you. And so, you know, you don't. So we went to M2G and we're like, oh, you know, I don't know. Like, what do you guys think about this? And I was like, they're like, if he gets it done, pay him. And so sure enough, we get the deal done. And somehow his client wound up finding out about it afterwards. And so they wound up firing him. And now I represent him and I've done another deal with him elsewhere. And I've actually become really good buddies with the guy that owns the distillery.
Yeah.
He's a cool guy. He's real into jujitsu and just kind of hit it off with like my MMA past. And then it's kind of just funny because it's like these guys, I mean, he got it. I don't even know how he met these guys. I think it was off a sign call off a sublease listing or whatever. And then he goes and does a, you know, 70,000 square foot, 10-year lease at, you know, high single digit rents. And it's just, you know, there's so many things that went right on that project to get it done. And it was just, it was really cool to be a part of it.
So I've got a funny story about that whole thing. This was one of the funniest things I think I've ever heard in my real estate career. So we're working on selling this distillery, that building. They want to have a conference call with Greenway and myself and them and this broker at Cushman. And they needed to do a zoning change on the property to get the distillery in at this location. And we were going to give them the time to do it and all that because we agreed to a good price on it. And we thought it would probably get approved just with all the transitioning in West Dallas. So we get on this call. And, you know, he like takes control of the conversation, da 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 da. And he goes, guys, the real big thing that we really need to get hammered out is the fact that we're going to have exclusivity to the building. And like everybody was just like dead silence, like deadpan silence. And we were, I can't remember if it was me or Todd, we responded. I go, you want a contract, right? He goes, yeah. I go, well, a contract gives you exclusivity? And he was like, yep, that's it. Okay, cool. Next point. I was like, what?
What are you talking about? I was
like, what are you even talking about, man? Like, we're talking about going under contract, which is an exclusive agreement. It was just like, I don't think this guy's ever sold a building before.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's probably just done tenor rep deals. So anyways, that's funny. It's funny how we all run, you know, on the UT Southwestern lease that got down on 2029, I had them almost in proposals on Mary Kay.
Really?
On the big building. That's how I knew they were in the market. And I don't know if you know this, but like, so we did the annex building and then we put the main building under contract. And then I had UT Southwestern touring it several times. They ended up not wanting to take it because of the Salvation Army going right next to it. And the whole point of them looking for new space is because they bought or they had another use. And the whole point that the Salvation Army was going there is because at the other site in the medical district area, UT Southwestern purchased the Salvation Army site to get them away from them. And that's where they're moving. So that ended up killing the Mary Kay deal. And I was just sitting in Rami's office one day and I was like, hey, dude, UT Southwestern's still in the market. He goes, well, let's get him, you know, get him in touch to lease 2929. So I can't remember who the broker's name was. He's kind of a one-off guy.
Yeah, one-off guy. I'd never heard of him before.
And so anyways, I was like, here's your building. So then they came and toured it. So that was a great deal.
That was a good one.
Rami loves that property and God, we've owned it for, I guess, 4 or 5 years now. So, but they've been a great tenant, you know, don't have to worry about getting paid.
Yeah, no kidding. Especially for Brook Hollow.
Yeah. So, well, let's see. So, you know, I like to always ask this too, like what's your kind of routine for your week and, you know, or, you know, what's made you successful in your career? Like just kind of the simple things that work on a consistent basis that have made you successful.
Yeah. You know, it's, you know, a lot of the training we got, especially once Boozer came over, is kind of the same, the old school NAI Robert Lind model. So, yep. I mean, I wake up at 5:45 every morning. I read something, try to just get my mind right, something positive. I like to read a lot of either sales books or something motivational or, mm-hmm. or spiritual, just get my head right and be in the office by between 7 and 7:30 and then, you know, plan out my day and go, you know, you have your task list, block off time for calls, and then just get out there and grind and go do it all over again. It's funny because, like, now I'm training guys over at Stream and, like, implementing partners and, like, implementing the same plan, but it's, like, it works, you know? And so it's just, for me, like, staying consistent and having the plan, it just kind of becomes your routine and you don't really think about it.
Yeah.
And then you wake up and it's, you know, it's Friday and you're like, Jesus, where'd the week go? And,
right.
But it's like, if you just do it, you know, it's funny. You hear everybody say, it's like, what we do is not rocket science, but, you know, and it's just the willingness to do things that other people don't want to do. You know, making cold calls all the time, it can be a beating. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it works.
Yeah.
You know? And no, so,
that's right. It's very simple. It's just work. That's all it is, you know. I've seen Jeff, like, have meetings with younger brokers, and they'll be like, what do I need to do to get better? He goes, I don't know, maybe just actually work the whole part of the plan I've given you.
Yeah.
You know, that's really all it is. That's what, like Keenan. Keenan is, you tell Keenan this is the plan, Keenan works it every week consistently. And I think that's what, young brokers got to understand that, hey, there's no hack to this.
No.
It's, you know.
It's so easy to identify when you're training people when they are trying to BS you. Because it's like, it's just simple, stupid.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you get out, you make your calls, prospect, present, follow up, and like good things will happen. I mean, you'll have bad days, you'll have bad weeks, but eventually things turn in your favor and you start making deals. And it's funny because it's just, you know, being in the business for a long time, you've seen all the excuses. You've seen people that didn't quite make it for one reason or another. And it's just like, they just didn't implement the plan and didn't execute it. And so.
It's, I remember I had a younger broker a couple of years ago at Mercer Company be like, I lost 2 deals today. I think I'm just going to go home. I was like,
not going to make it.
You ain't going to make it, bro. I was like, cool. I lost a lot more than that in one day before. And the only cure for that is more cold calls.
Yeah.
Like, really, it's all, I think you can cure anything through just more cold calls.
Yeah, I agree.
So, well, you're a big reader. What's one of your favorite books you've read that was really changing for you?
You know, I alternate between like fiction and nonfiction.
Okay.
So, I mean,
let's go both. I want fiction and nonfiction recommendations. You know, it's
funny. I mentioned this when I walked in earlier. I was like, I noticed some of your books. Like, I mean, I read The Daily Stoic a few months ago. I'm reading a book right now called The Circle Maker.
Yeah.
Which is it was written by like a famous pastor in DC. And one of the guys in my Bible study recommended it to me, but it's not really a salesy book. It's really more about like dreaming big, writing down your goals and praying about it, mm-hmm. which in my way, a lot of that can be applied to like what we do and sales and just talking about like, you know, whether you want to call it manifestation or, you know, being optimistic, but kind of creating a plan, implementing a plan, having God involved and then going out and executing.
Yeah.
And so I started reading it thinking it was just going to be kind of some kind of a religious book, which I don't, other than, you know, the Bible, I don't really read those types of things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's my first one, but in a lot of ways, I think it's like one of the better sales books I've read it, but it's not really meant to be. It just kind of motivates you in that way, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. So that's your nonfiction.
That's my nonfiction. And then fiction, I don't know if you know Tom Robbins, but a good buddy of mine, Cole Suttle, who has a book club called the Helping Friendly Book Club. They put out like a different book every month, and he's been doing it for, I think they're up to like, I can't even remember how many years ago, but there's a really funny fiction writer, Tom Robbins, and a lot of it. Have you ever read any of his stuff?
No.
but it's like Jitterbug perfume. Like a lot of this stuff's just kind of wild, over the top stuff. And a lot of times he's poking fun at whatever was going on at the time with the garage to like politics or religion or whatever.
Yeah.
And so like when these books were, you know, written, a lot of it's just, it's kind of like relatable.
Yeah.
And some people it kind of offends. Mm-hmm. And so it's funny because I'll meet like some of my friends, especially people that are like more devout, are shocked that I like Tom Robbins. But mm-hmm. I think it's like, that's why I like it. Like I can read something I don't agree with and think it's funny.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, Tom Robbins.
That's cool. Now, what's something you would tell your younger self if you could?
That's a good question. Probably, you know, when I first got into brokerage, the whole consistent and persistent thing, it took me a while to learn. Mm-hmm. I didn't come out of the gates and like crush it.
Yeah.
I mean, I was so terrified of cold calling when I started. I used to read a sales book a month just to try to, you know, I would go drive the market the day before, write everything down, and then go cold call the next day and like, you know, cram my 100 calls into basically like 4 days because I was so terrified. Mm-hmm. I probably would have told my younger self to just like implement the plan sooner. Yeah. It took me a couple of years to kind of figure it out. I'm glad I stuck with it. But I mean, I was so nervous and terrible when I started like knocking on doors. And I used to be, I mean, I'm embarrassed to even admit this, but I mean, I'd get terrified and go in if the building was too big, and I'd go run in and hope no one was there, drop off my business card, and then like go back and do
that one. Yeah. That one done. I've done. Everybody's done that. They're like, oh, good. Yeah, that counts.
That counts. And then like, you know, stuff like business. Now it's easier because you can like research companies before, you know.
I mean, yeah, we didn't really have any good tools.
No. I mean, and so once some of those tools, I mean, I think it probably coincided with some of that technology coming out. Mm-hmm. Because if I knew if someone owned or leased the building and I knew a name or at least could look up the business, well, then my confidence level completely changed.
Yeah.
And so I wish I had implemented the plan sooner. Mm-hmm. It probably would have made those first couple of years in the business a little less rocky.
Yeah.
But that's what I always tell our guys is just like, it's not rocket science. Like we do our Monday morning meetings that just like a lot of these shops do and go through our call list. And, you know, it doesn't take long to realize who's implementing the plan and who's not.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. It shows at the sales meeting who's doing it and who's lying about it. Right.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people will lie about what they did last week and they're just lying to themselves.
Exactly.
I don't think some brokers don't understand that those Monday morning meetings that you're probably having an accountability meeting from the previous week, you know, and that's really not for you as the guy running the industrial group, guys. It's really for them, but they need to understand that. And, you know, it's funny. We had one guy at Mercer Company. He's not there anymore, but he would never do the weekend organ time stuff. And I was like, hey, dude, I would just look at him every time in there. When I'd be like, I mean, do you want to be good or you want to be like very average? And he's like, what? I'm like, well, you're not doing the plan. Plan is you organize your week during the weekend for at least 2 hours. And I could never get him to do it. And he was a very mediocre broker his whole career throughout then.
That's a huge part of it.
It is. And you can only sell between 8 and 5 Monday through Friday, really. So those other times, you better be doing everything else. So, well, what's something outside of real estate or something interesting about you that not most people know or something unique?
So when I was younger, well, I played rugby for SMU. That was something I was into for a while.
Yeah.
But I was really into, for like a decade, MMA.
Yeah.
And wanted to train for like Golden Gloves and all that stuff, and started in college. And when I was at Lee and Associates, Nathan thought it, you know, he would give me a hard time because I mean, I'd show up to the office sometimes. And I mean, like, I didn't just like train, I wanted to start like fighting. I didn't have like aspirations of being like a UFC fighter, but I wanted to do amateur fights and train for that. And I'd like show up to Lee like limping with like cuts on my face or like black eyes. And like Trey and Nathan had to sit me down one day and they're like, man, like, don't get us wrong. Like, we think what you're doing is like really cool. But like one of my training deals, I broke my, whatever you call your what, I guess, pointer toe on one of my feet. And so, I mean, I was like limping around because there's nothing you can do except stay off it.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was just like limping around for months. Yeah. And it wasn't until like the holidays came around and I went and visited my grandma for Thanksgiving. And I'd like just like literally like for days just had my foot elevated with ice on it. So I wasn't limping around. They're like, dude, you just, it's cool what you're doing, but you got to stop because you can't be showing up to meetings with cuts on your face, wobbling around. Yeah. And but yeah, that's something not many people know about me.
So it's pretty fun. My son started jujitsu in January, and I started it with him, and it's been pretty fun.
But that's cool.
We're doing Muay Thai as well, and man,
that was my favorite.
I fucked my foot up the other day. Like, we were doing head kicks, and I missed top of my foot, boom, right on this guy's elbow, and like my foot exploded. Like, I hit the ground, and I looked at it, and the other guy that I kicked was looking at my foot, and we just watched the hematoma just go. Like, I mean, it looked like a mountain on top of my foot. I finally put a boot on today for the first
time. Really?
Yeah.
Do you know who Guy Mesger is?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So Guy Mesger Combat Sports Club, I trained there for years. It was like a few blocks away from the Lee and Associates office when I started. And so they had like a Muay Thai class that would start at like 7:30. So, I mean, I'd leave the office at 7, run over there and just start training. That's what I loved. And I mean, Guy Mesger was Ken Shamrock's original training partner. You know, Ken Shamrock won one of the early UFCs. Oh, yeah. Like, he's like, was there from the beginning. And so I remember training there, and like, there were guys there that literally like delivered paint at night, and they would train there every day because like this was their shot in life.
Yeah.
And just like blue collar, you know, training every day around the clock, you know, jiu-jitsu, Muay Thai, karate, boxing, whatever they could do, because like this was their shot in life. And I thought that was really cool. And when I left Lee for Stream, at the time, all the MMA gyms that in like Uptown and stuff were like going from that atmosphere to people that were like training, trying to be professionals, to like your Uptown guys that thought it was cool to go try to go fight. I was like, man, I can't do this.
Yeah.
And so.
A little different. Yeah.
Can't take you guys seriously.
It's, I had trained a little bit a couple of years ago at Next Generation in Frisco, and they have a lot of fighters in there. So it was, we would train with fighters in there. Now,
it's a different vibe.
It's a very different vibe because you can tell like, that's all these guys do. This is to your point. This is their life. Like this is their ticket.
Profession. This is their.
Yeah. And man, what a hard profession, because a lot of them don't make it and they don't make any money.
No.
And, my son's really good. My son has some itch to scratch, and I'm hoping this is it, because he really wanted to do bareback bronc riding. And I'm like, you're not having that, man. Come on. And, you know, he loves playing football. He's great at it. But like, I think jiu-jitsu is really getting into, he loves Muay Thai as well. Like, he's really, and he's wrestled for a long time in his past, but he fought in his first tournament this last weekend, and got second place in it. He had to fight up in weight class, and he got beat by a kid that outweighs him by 50 pounds. It's actually his buddy. I roll with the guy, you know? And so,
he's a huge
kid. And, but It's been really fun, man. I've really enjoyed it. And the place we train at now, a lot of people compete there. So it's more of, you know, they kind of push everybody to compete. So a lot of people are there competing. And then there's some people that are, you know, like really trying to like, you know, be a, you know, an MMA fighter, where, you know, a lot of it's jiu-jitsu driven fighting for the most part. But it's addicting.
It is.
You know, like eventually I'm probably going to throw the keys to Will and be like, I'm doing jiu-jitsu all day. See you later. So
I want to get back into it. I messed up my knee a few years ago in a motorcycle accident. Mm-hmm. So I had stem cell done, and I feel like I wanted to avoid getting surgery. So I'm almost back. Like, I can ski now without a knee brace, things like that. Yeah. But I've got some buddies that do jiu-jitsu at the Octagon. They're wanting me to get back into it. And I was like, man, I don't know if somebody starts pulling on my knee, I'm afraid I might do, but I want to get back into jiu-jitsu. I mean, it's, or not jiu-jitsu, Muay Thai.
I'm kind of torn right now. Which one's more dangerous? I kind of feel like I have a bigger shot at getting hurt in Muay Thai, just because the impacts are a lot harder sometimes. Because, I mean, it's, you know, God, dude, when you get kicked, like, that sucks.
Yeah.
Like, that sucks. Like, especially by a guy who knows how to kick. Like, there's a lot of difference between getting kicked and getting kicked by someone who knows how to kick and how to whack, you know?
True.
Like, it's funny, you watch this, man, we were watching a fight the other night, dude, and I mean, this guy, you know, it's weird. I don't know why people don't do it more often, but when they start kicking that leg,
yeah,
and they just dead that dude's leg and they just grind on it all night throughout the fight, the guy can't move, yeah, you know?
Yeah, game over.
And, but jujitsu, you know, I think the good thing about jujitsu is like a lot of people, there's a lot of older people that do it.
So, a lot of people are getting into it now too, yeah, which I think is really interesting.
It is. I think there's a lot more visibility to the sport. I think there's a lot of people that are going to get in. There's a lot of older people that will get into it. So you can kind of like, you can kind of dial it down a little bit if, yeah, you find the right partner. I mean, if you know, you know, so when we'll roll up there, it's like you can find the guy. Like if you want to go full speed, that guy goes full speed. If you want to go, you know, you can kind of dial it up and down. So. But
it's a very humbling sport.
Oh, it makes you never want to pick a bar fight.
Yeah, no,
I'll
kidding.
Tell you that. Like, I look at some people in there, I'm like, I would so have picked a fight with you in college.
Yeah.
And you would have wrapped me up like a freaking pretzel.
Did you ever see that? There was a video clip going around a few years ago of, it was like some football players. I want to say it was OU.
It was OU football.
And they were
players.
Picking on those young kids.
Yeah.
And like they just got the crap kicked out of them, yep, by two small wrestlers.
Yeah.
They MMA experience just abused them.
It was like those guys didn't know what hit. It was in a bathroom in a, yeah, bar. And they're just talking mad trash to them. And that one of the MMA kids just starts going, yep, you, yep, want some? Like you could just tell he was gearing up. And dude, when it went off, like, those football players didn't know what hit them.
No.
They were down on the ground, like, couldn't breathe. Yeah,
no, like, they were, like, more than double the size. Oh, I mean, the size difference easily was huge.
But it was over in 2 seconds. I mean, I was rolling with a blue belt the other day. I probably have 60 pounds on him. I mean, that guy screwed me up just every time. Just every, dude, you know, it's just, you know, 5 minutes of just getting my brains kicked in by that guy. You know, if I looked at him on the street, I'd be like, oh, I would smoke him. But, mm-mm. So, yeah.
You never know.
Yeah, you never know. And that, doing that will teach you that you never know.
Yeah, that's why you don't pick on people. I started training, I think, seriously, like my sophomore or junior year in college. Mm-hmm. I took a judo class. And I don't, you know, like most kids, like parents had me in like taekwondo, karate growing up and whatever.
Yeah.
But I played football mostly in high school and ran track. And so I took this judo class my freshman year at SMU and loved it. And that's, yeah, kind of what kickstarted it. But once I really started learning how to fight, I mean, I haven't been in a fight since my sophomore year of college.
Yeah.
And did you just kind of learn to respect that? Because at the end of the day, you never know. Like once you start getting to your point, like jujitsu and stuff like that, you don't pick on people. You have no idea. First of all, you don't pick on people because that's not a good thing to do.
No.
But like, it's just, to your point, some of these jujitsu guys are just so unsuspecting, and, yeah, you just never know what you're going to get into. And so
it's over quick. I had a teammate of mine in college that would pick fights, and he picked one time, and it didn't end well for him. And it was like ended very bad. He picked a fight at a stoplight with a guy, and they took off, and it was real icy outside, and they slid. He hit a pole, paralyzed him from the neck down for picking a fight.
Oh my God.
This guy would have been in the NFL too. He transferred, really, in from Ohio State, and it was over Thanksgiving weekend, and I was glad I wasn't there because I hung out with this guy every weekend, and I was like, I would probably have been in that car with him.
That's terrible.
You know, but he, man, he would pick a fight constantly, you know, and he could back it up, you know, but it wasn't, you know, if you do stuff like that, eventually it's going to catch up with you.
Yeah.
You know, and
karma.
And it caught him, man. And it was a sad deal. So, but, well, that's interesting, man. I knew you'd always kind of done that stuff, but I didn't realize you did it that long. So,
yeah, I was really into it for a long time.
Yeah. You need to get back into it. You still got it, man. Come on.
I said 3 years ago, my motorcycle accident, I think, was like 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And so I did stem cell, everything was fine. And then it's funny, like at my nephew's birth, like 10-year-old birthday party a year ago, mm-hmm. it was at a trampoline park. Some little brat came up and like double jumped me when I was like playing with my daughter. And my knee got messed up again. And so I've been getting stem cell treatments again.
So what did you do to your knee?
So I, yeah, I have motorcycles and, well, now I've got one, but I used to have two. And so I was driving and this guy was in a AT&T bucket truck, you mm-hmm. know, those ones that go up, you know, yep, service yep. power lines or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like it had been raining and it was over in Lakewood and I think it was like on Live Oak or something, but it was, or anyway, it doesn't matter where it is, but there are speed bumps. And so this guy was driving and come to find out he was like texting and not paying attention. He just like slams on the brakes like right in front of me. Yeah. And it was when I had my bike very long. And so I had to like divert to not run into the back of this bucket truck. And so funny thing is like, I would have been much more beat up if I hadn't done MMA. Cause like, I know how to fall.
You know how to fall. Yeah.
And so I was an idiot. I was wearing like Chuck Taylor's jeans, a t-shirt, no helmet.
Yeah.
And like, I'm lucky I didn't hit my head, but when I landed, I just like threw my arm out and rolled. Yeah. And the guy gets out of his car, comes back, and like my bike's still running. And I'm like, but I can't lift it up. Like the adrenaline, like the pain hadn't kicked in yet, but I didn't have enough strength to like pick up my motorcycle because like my body's messed up.
Yeah.
And this guy gets out, like come to, I mean, I probably could have sued AT&T over this. Yeah. I mean, the guy was like, I was texting, sorry. And I was so embarrassed because I was like, I hadn't had my bike that long.
Yeah.
He was like, what do you need? And I was just like, just help me get my bike up. And so I just drove home. And I was like, I was just like, I drove home. And to add insult to injury, my girlfriend at the time had locked me out of the house. And I'm just like, and she's like in the shower or something like that. And it starts raining again. So I'm like, I just crashed my motorcycle. I get home. Rain's coming down. Locked out of my house. Like the adrenaline's starting to fade. My body's just hurting. And and then like she comes and finally opens the door. I'm like, where the hell have you been? Blah, blah, blah. And she's like, I saw her in the shower. And so I didn't want to have to go get surgery. And so I literally started doing, I got really into yoga.
Yeah.
And I'm a huge advocate. I like healed my body. I found up flying down. This was before like stem cell was like even available in the US. And so like I went to Costa Rica a week and got stem cell treatment. And like, it was like this healthy living retreat. And then it's like, cause you're supposed to go down. It's like the belief that like what you put in your body when you have like an injury.
Yeah.
So it's like a very specific diet. They did like daily yoga. You'd have your stem cell treatment and then you just like chill out. And it was almost like kind of like an outpatient clinic, but it was cool. Cause you're in the jungle of Costa Rica.
Yeah.
And like, so went and did that and then like healed my body, like just doing the stem cell and the yoga. And then fast forward to that kid's trampoline birthday party. And I was just like, and so I'm almost back, but I'm just kind of apprehensive. I went skiing a couple months ago and it was the first time I'd skied without like a brace on.
Yeah.
And I was fine. I mean, I was like, if I can ski double blacks without, you know, without a brace, but I'm a little nervous about getting in the MMA deal. Cause I'm like, is this stupid? Cause I hurt myself again. I really don't want to have to get surgery.
Yeah, no, surgery sucks. I had to do it. Was
it on your shoulder?
My ankle.
Ankle.
So they completely reconstructed it and rerouted everything. And it's 10 weeks immobile. And then when I finally came out, I was like, put me back in the boot. Like I still couldn't walk on it. So I was really probably immobile for 13 to 14 weeks on my foot.
Is everything good now?
Yeah, it's.
Can you tell a difference?
Yeah, it's. I can tell a little difference. I kind of traded one set of problems. I traded one set of problems for a lesser set of problems. So I'll take that as a win. But I have to definitely wear one of those ASO braces when I do Muay Thai because, you know, you're turning your ankle a lot during that stuff, especially when you're kicking and all that stuff. So I brace it up pretty good for that.
No problems with the brace?
No, the brace works pretty good because it supports everything up. It's one of those ASO ones, so it straps underneath this way, and then comes around like that. And it's pretty good. It works.
So maybe I'll look into one of those for my knee.
They have these jiu-jitsu knee braces. because a lot of older guys have issues with their knees in jujitsu, and this is like, hey, save your knees in jujitsu, and they have these braces. So look those up. I'll see. I'm sure it's in my Instagram feed or something, because that's all my Instagram feed now is a bunch of fights. And I'll send it to you. So, but well, awesome, man. This was fun. It's great just getting to catch up again and getting to hear your story, and, you know, glad everybody will get to hear this. And so, you know, it's been fun, man. It's been fun running, working together, and we'll have you out here again. And, Haynes Chatham, everybody. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.